and Mario Grasso of Navarex. 16-meter beam, draft 5 meters, and empty is 5,300 gross tons. Round bilged hull displacement. She can cruise at 14 knots, officially, but I had some guys tinker with it, and we can get up to 20 in a pinch. Staterooms for 22 people, and I am not shopping to buy it, interrupted Santoro. He snatched up a towel and began drying off. How conspicuous is this boat?
Very, said Kuga. Big, garish thing, but it's registered to someone else. A Canadian billionaire, I know. He was born to money and has no politics at all. I, on the other hand, have lots of footage of him with kids, so I own him. Besides, he's Canadian, and who the fuck ever looks twice at a silly rich Canuck?
Centaurus scowled but said nothing, which made Kuga grin.
You'll love the name, too. The Soul of Piety. The owner thinks that's funny as balls. He's a total hedonist scumbag, so I guess it is. The boat has great range, but we can stop at the usual places to refuel, make it look casual. There's such an amazing control center aboard that we can run our operations at sea. And I have a gal working for me who knows how to spook her way into telecom satellites without tripping any alarms. A couple of great internet jockeys, too. They look like a couple of stoners. I call them Jay and Silent Bob. One of them worked for Putin. Well, actually, Silent Bob's always worked for me, but Putin thought the kid worked for him. You know how that is. Hugo didn't own the patent on building secret networks.
No.
The other kid, Jay, was a boy genius who everybody thought was going to be scouted by Apple or Microsoft, but he's such an unlikable asshole that no one wanted to hire him. And when Silicon Valley thinks you're too much of a dick, well. So I snatched him up. Maybe neither is on the same level as that freak Bug, but together? Yeah, they fit like two batteries in a dildo.
Centaurus made a small, disgusted sound. The fighters in the yard were setting up cork targets for knife drills. There were 24 of them, men and women. All of them were former military, and each had spent time working for private contractors in places where nobody really looked over their shoulders. They were dangerous as hell before Centaurus recruited them, and they'd all come a long way since. No one trained people quite like the little Spaniard.
Digging the way your new kingsmen are coming along, by the way, tough as hell.
They're not kingsmen, insisted Santoro.
He tossed the towel onto another lounge chair, took a bottle of water from the patio wet bar, and sat.
The seven kings are dead.
Then what do we call them? Henchmen? Minions? Now wait, we'd get sued by Universal. Even I'm scared of entertainment lawyers.
I am open to suggestions. It was Hugo Vox who picked the name Kingsman.
So it's on me?
Mused Kuga. He scooted up and sipped his drink. His fake tan had been replaced with a golden, natural one, and the lines of stress had softened around his mouth. In the months since leaving the prison, he'd put on 10 pounds of useful muscle and shed 15 years of unearned age. The two of them batted some possible names back and forth for a while, but discarded most of the choices as either too corny, too obvious, or uninteresting.
The key, said Santoro, is to give them what amounts to a flag. A name matters. It defines who they are and what they believe in. Kings in so many cultures claimed descent from the gods, or at least divine blessing.
Okay, said Kuga. So are you suggesting we call ourselves kings? I mean, two kings doesn't have quite the gravitas of seven kings. What if we go old school? I like the sound of the immortals.
Centaurus considered, lips pursed, and shook his head.
I have never liked that name. It is effective up until one of them is killed by someone who is demonstrably lesser than the standard they hold for themselves. King Leonidas of Sparta proved that at the Hot Gates when he sent his youngest hoplites to gut the first ranks of Persian immortals. It made a statement that probably cost Xerxes another 100 casualties through loss of heart.
Point taken. Kuga drained his glass, the ice cubes rattling against his lips. He got up and built another drink. I like that other group, the cats who worked for Howard Shelton and that Majestic 3 program.
The Closers?
Yes, great name. It was more about what they did than any false claims of immortality or invulnerability. Santoro chewed on that, nodding slowly. They heard a yell and turned to see one of the fighters doing a drill in which he ducked, dove, rolled, and leapt while throwing knives at targets on corkboard posts. He hit 5 of 8 targets in kill zones. He tried again and made 6 kills. Kuga and Santoro nodded.
Hey, said Kuga. What about something like the Closers? What about the Fixers? That has a ring to it, and let's face it, it fits with what's implied with that Concierge de l'Enfer thing they hung on me.
The Fixers.
Santoro tasted the name.
The Fixers, said Kuga, giving it some real weight.
And the Fixers it became. The two men lay on their chairs and watched the Fixers train, watched the oil grace with which they moved, the sureness and steadiness, and the coldness.
They'll never see us coming, murmured Kuga.
No, said Santoro. They will not.
Chapter 65. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. We flew into hell. That's what it looked like, even from the air. Yeonpyeong is actually the name of a group of small islands in the Yellow Sea, roughly 50 miles west of Incheon, and only 7.5 miles south of the North Korean province of Hwanghae. The main island is Daeyeonpyeongdo, which means Big Yeonpyeong, but everyone tends to refer to that just as Yeonpyeong. The smaller islands were less important, and right now anyone living on those more remote specks of land were lucky. They were probably still alive. Yeonpyeong Island was burning. We circled the island, the osprey moving like some great prehistoric bird between columns of smoke, brown and gray from blazing homes, a sour gray-green from the crab processing plant, and oily black from the gas dock in the ferry port. Cars and trucks burned in the streets. People did, too. We could see blackened bodies wreathed in fire sprawled in the streets, their limbs curling as the hellish heat leached moisture from their tendons. Unlike Gagulisyom, though, the slaughter on this island was not past tense. We were not visiting a grave, but a charnel house. Figures chased each other through the smoke. Some fought and wrestled in the streets. Some wandered like zombies, their clothes torn and streaked with blood. We saw people hiding from screaming madmen, crouching down behind cars, or hunkered down in the weeds, looking for safety in a place where it might no longer exist. I saw one man standing by a wrecked golf cart using what looked like a shoulder-mounted movie camera to hammer down on a body that was little more than red hamburger. He kept hitting over and over again, even though the man, if it had been a man he was assaulting, was long dead.
"Everyone get ready,"
growled Top, and the stridence and power of his voice shook the team out of a hypnotic trance of watching the horror show below.
"Let's do it, people."
Everyone broke loose of their shock. They buddy-checked each other's hammer suit seals and strapped themselves into their rappelling gear. Even though there were plenty of places to set down, we weren't risking the crew or the plane. As soon as we were down, Bird Dog would begin hosing everything down with a powerful disinfectant. We clipped on, and when Pluto and Goofy opened the hatch, we slithered down into the madness. Our landing zone was a field on the edge of town. We disconnected, and the Osprey lifted and turned from the LZ, taking its noise and wind and safety with it. Before the doors closed, a flock of drones burst out, large and small, seagulls and pigeons, and a swarm of insect drones that clustered and swarmed and then followed us down and then spread themselves onto the breeze. Each machine moved like the creature it was designed to imitate, with flight patterns and sounds dictated by ultra-sophisticated software. But they went where Doc Holliday sent them. I needed Andrea's hands on his dart gun and not drone controls, at least for now. Havoc spread out and established a perimeter, guns up and out. I saw Top watching Mun, making sure, as I'd also done, that the weapon in her small, strong hands was a Snellig and not a Glock. She must have sensed Top and me watching because she looked over her shoulder at us. There was nothing, no nod, no word, just her letting us know she knew. Fair enough. I hadn't liked the fact that we were all on a shared channel, though I understood the necessity for it, and now I wished I could have had a few quick private chats, one with Bug to get more background on Mun. Something about her made me twitch, and it wasn't merely her lack of social skills. Would also like to have talked to Top, but he must have sensed that, as he often did, and gave me a small nod while cutting his eyes at Mun. He was going to keep an eye on her and was telling me that he had that covered so I could focus on leading this little school trip. Top can compress a lot into a look.
"Call the play, boss," said Bunny.
"We head to the center of town and then see what's what," I said. "Anyone comes toward you, put them down. Don't worry about cuffs, just dart them and move on. We are badly outnumbered and I don't want to risk any other boots on the ground. They won't know how to do this right."
"Hurrah," said Top.
"Call signs and common sense. Nobody outside of our official loop should be able to pick up our proprietary channels, but if they do, anything we say is going out prime time. Let's be circumspect." Our hammer suits had WHO and biohazard emblems in bright colors, and you had to be real close to see much through the plastic hood visors. The mission channel was being monitored by four friends of Mr. Church, one from each country. They were supposed to be friendlies, but friendship could get seriously strained when actual national security came into play. If we ran into the guys who almost certainly delivered this bioweapon, and if they turned out to be real SEALs and real ROK soldiers, then things could turn south real damn fast. The fact that the Frog Island stuff was still under wraps was kind of amazing, but also scary. None of us believed that the silence would or could last. As if reading my mind, Top asked,
"What do we do if we run into some actual bad guys?"
"We take them," I said. "Juice them, if at all possible. I need someone with a pulse so I can have a deep and meaningful conversation. Feel me?"
"Hoorah," said everyone except Ho and Mun, but they nodded.
We moved out. Interlude 15. Aboard the Soul of Piety, Quayside Marina, Vancouver, British Columbia, 8 months ago.
"I like what you've been doing with the fixers, Raphael," said Kuga. They walked slowly together along the finger pier toward the big yacht.
Two fixers walked ahead, two behind. The guards were dressed in boating clothes, but an experienced eye could tell what they were. None of these guys were looking at the small party.
"I'm glad you are pleased," said Santoro. "Recruitment is up 40% and attrition is low. We will have more than enough troops for the upcoming operations. We are doing equally well with infiltration operations, and we have an overabundance of minders keeping an eye on the families of our unwilling recruits. Everything we set in motion has greatly exceeded expectations."
"Glad to hear it."
"We are so well positioned, in fact," continued Santoro, "that I don't think we need to wait any longer to start several other operations we have been planning."
"That's even better."
"As long as you have the nerve for that kind of expansion."
Kuga shot him a look, but he saw Santoro break into a rare grin.
"Ah, humor. It's a good look on you, Raphael. Maybe I'll book you into some stand-up clubs."
They reached the gangplank, which was guarded by yet another pair of fixers. Santoro paused, touching Kuga's arm lightly.
Do you remember our conversation about what to call ourselves, our organization?
Sure, that was the day we picked the name Fixers. Why?
I have been giving it some considerable thought. The Seven Kings' name was picked partly in support of a propaganda program. The intention was to hijack the mystique and many of the long-standing conspiracy rumors about secret societies and repurpose them to suggest that the Kings was an ancient cult and one with vast secrets and some supernatural elements. Viewed from a distance, that sounds perhaps silly, but when fed incrementally to the internet rumor mill, it was very effective. We had scores of web experts hacking into databases to change what was there and insert the King's legend into it. They even modified PDFs of doctoral theses on university websites, and we covertly funded the publication of hundreds of books, paid for speaking tours, bankrolled History Channel specials, and so on. Much of that information is still there, and a lot of people still believe that the Kings were, in fact, an ancient order dating back to Sargon the Akkadian.
That's impressive as hell, agreed Kuga. Are you suggesting we do the same?
Santoro smiled.
I am suggesting we do nothing.
What?
We already have a mystique. Kuga, I have been going through your own records and also conducting deep dives into what is on the net. Kuga has become far more than your cover name, my friend. You have become the Professor Moriarty of the real world. There are thousands of crimes and actions ascribed to Kuga that I know you had no part in. There are, by my count, 43 people who claim to be Kuga, operating at various levels of the international black market. The name has become a legend.
He paused.
At first I was tempted to smash these pretenders, but now I believe that they are useful. They are self-sustaining misdirection, yes? They muddy the water and distract the eye.
And because your own organization ran things so efficiently while you were incarcerated, it would be a very difficult thing to attach your real name to the person called Kuga. So, it seems to me that we are looking to name something that is already named, and to build a mystique that already exists.
Nothing grandiose?
Nothing grandiose. You are not a cartoon villain, my friend. You are not political. You are certainly not a religious zealot. And you are not trying to take over the world. What you are is a businessman. Any collateral damage done by my fixers or our other operatives is not from malice. It is simply the cost of doing business. The name Kuga is the business and the brand, and it's all the mystique we need.
Kuga walked to the end of the finger pier and stared down at the pelicans bobbing in the water. He was smiling, and then he was nodding. Chapter 66. Hotel Ryumeikan, Tokyo, Japan. Eve made the call. They lay in bed together, and when Santoro answered, she and Adam leaned together to listen. Santoro answered with,
"Line?"
"Clear."
"And?"
"It's done, and it's good,"
said Eve.
"Really good."
"Send it to me."
"I did,"
said Adam.
"It's on your business account."
That was code for one of the many coded email accounts on the dark web they used for this kind of work. Like the burners, it would be discarded, in this case scrubbed and deleted, with a very nasty virus left like a landmine for anyone who chanced to find the account. There was a long pause while Santoro watched the video. They could both hear noise and dialogue from the file. Eve tried to massage Adam's crotch while they waited, more of a nervous thing than actual sex, but he pushed her hand away. He was a million miles from hard. After about 1,000 years, Santoro said,
"This will work."
Adam closed his eyes and thumped his head against the pillow. Eve bent and kissed his cheek. Centauro told them when and where to upload it.
After that, destroy whatever computer you used for the upload. Completely. Do not merely wipe it, but physically destroy it, yes?
Yes, sure, absolutely.
You will not, under any circumstances, disappoint me, said Centauro.
He made it a statement and left all of the threats implied. Eve and Adam looked at each other, both of them going pale beneath their tans. They were monsters, but Centauro was a god of monsters. Their god. And in a flash it took Eve back to Haven House, the home for troubled youths in Montana near Flathead Lake, back to when she and Adam first met. It was like stepping into a nightmare for her, and that was a journey she hadn't taken in a long time. One she hadn't been broken enough to take since coming to work for Centauro. That night, though, still burned in her mind like a hot coal. She had died then, or at least a girl named Katie McHugh had died then. It had been Katie who'd been arrested all those times for theft and arson. Eve was still waiting to be born. It was Katie who'd been punched so hard in the stomach by Mike Tillerson that she couldn't breathe, let alone scream for help. It had been Katie who the six older teens dragged into the shed behind the main house. It had been Katie who had her own underwear stuffed into her mouth to stifle the screams as the boys took her over and over and over again, invading her body in every possible way, tearing her. Ruining her, laughing and slapping and punching in places where it wouldn't show, taking cell phone pictures staged to look like compliance. The boys were wise in their cruelty and thorough in their degradation. It was Adam who found her. He had already shed the skin of Ryan O'Connor by then. That was why he was at Haven. They thought he was still salvageable by their standards. They thought he was wayward, the favored words of the cornball boneheads who ran the place. They had no idea what he'd already become. Adam was walking back from the lake with a pair of cutthroat trout and a fat rainbow on a hook, whistling a tune that followed no sense or order. He must have heard her because she was invisible in the dark, under the bushes where she'd crawled. If he hadn't come along, Katie might have made it all the way to the lake, and then no one would ever have found her. She saw the fish fall to the ground, heard the bushes rustle, felt hands reaching in, touching her. Katie screamed, but Adam pulled her out, wrapped her in his arms, held her close. He did not ask what happened. She was naked, and there was blood on her thighs and buttocks. He bent his head close and wept with her. Later, as they sat on rocks by the lake, watching the moon roll like a white marble across the black table of the sky, he asked her two questions, only those two. First, he asked her name. He knew it from Haven, but asked it anyway. When she didn't answer, she hadn't rediscovered the mechanics of speaking yet. He told her that although everyone called him Ryan, his real name was Adam. He explained that he'd become that after the 100th night his mother had come into his room, when he still lived at home, when his mother was still alive. He told her, without edit or delicacy, what he had done on that 100th night, the scissors and hammer and carpet knife and hacksaw. He told her everything, every single thing. One day ago, she would have been shocked and horrified. She'd have run from him as fast as she could. She might even have told on him. A day ago, even 3 hours ago. That would have been Katie believing. As she listened to the story of Ryan becoming Adam, the first man created in the new world that was inside his head, she felt Katie falter. She felt Katie die. A part of her tried to hold on, to reach back into the gathering darkness to catch Katie's hand, but the tidal pull was far too strong by that point, and Katie McHugh drowned there by Flathead Lake. She didn't call herself Eve that night. No, that was much later. She first used it when she and Adam got into the car that belonged to Haven's chief of security. In the glow of the burning building, she looked into the rearview mirror and saw only her own eyes and now the burning building.
"I'm Eve," she said.
"I know,"
he said. They drove away. The police looked for the wrong people. They looked for Katie and Ryan, and both of them were long dead. The hunt intensified when it was later discovered that six of the teenage boys at Haven had not died from either smoke inhalation or burns. No, their bodies were found in a shed set well apart from the house. So far apart, one investigator noted in an interview, that probably no one in the main building could have heard them screaming. The things that had been done to them were so graphic that even the bloodthirsty reporters tended to summarize. Adam and Eve were never found. Later, once the two of them had begun cultivating a useful set of skills, all computer records of the people they'd been vanished from databases and emails. The living had become ghosts of the useless dead. Since then, no one had ever really hurt them again. No one had that kind of power. Until they met Rafael Santoro. Daddy. He had never hurt them, not even touched them, but what did that matter? He'd taught them the art of pain and coercion and torture, beautiful arts when used against others rather than directed toward them. So much power, so sexy. No, erotic. Sensual in the truest definition of that word, because it engaged all five senses in ways that made their subjects totally alive and completely aware of every nerve signal. Santoro had never directly threatened them, not once, but he'd taught them the cost of disappointing expectations. They'd watched him, the master artist at work, on people who had disappointed him. Now, hearing him on the phone, Eve felt as if she was the one strapped to one of Santoro's chairs, naked and vulnerable, with every nerve ending totally awake in dreadful anticipation.
No, Daddy, stammered Adam. We would never disappoint you.
But there was no one on the line anymore. Chapter 67. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. There was a government building at the edge of town, and we approached it quietly and slowly. There were corpses in the tall grass that edged the parking lot. The grass was stiff and brittle, murdered by the winter cold, and it rustled with a sound like rat claws on old floorboards. Ahead, we saw a man standing in the shade of a tree, a big fire axe in his hands. His shoulders rose and fell as if with extreme exhaustion. Top was on point and held up a fist for everyone else to stop. We covered him with our weapons as he crept forward, the Snellig raised. Top can move like a cat when he wants to. The memory of Sergeant Chung and the little girl was playing on a big movie screen in my head, and I willed Top to be careful. I could feel Bunny fidgeting beside me. The man with the fire axe was looking off into the blue nothing and was not aware of Top's approach. Maybe he was an uninfected person who'd used the axe to defend himself, or maybe he was something else. The axe was smeared with blood, and the man's clothes were spattered. Flies swarmed around him. The talk sent the feed from Top's body cam to a corner of my visor, and I saw what he saw. We all did. We saw the red, torn, inhuman lumps of things glistening wetly in the grass. We saw the body of a child, what had been a child, sprawled in the dirt, her little arms wrapped around a small dog.
God,
breathed Bunny. That was the only word anyone spoke. Top began to circle wide, well out of the reach of that axe, our weapons all pointed at the man. We watched as Top stepped into the man's periphery, into the line of sight. The man had been motionless except for the movement of his shoulders. Now his head lifted and turned toward the movement. There was a moment when nothing at all happened. My finger slipped inside the dart gun's trigger guard. Top knew a little Korean, just enough. He said,
Namal Dulyusio. Listen to me, sir. Dokikulul Nalyo Nwajwo.
I need you to put the axe down. The pronunciation was fair, the meaning clear, accompanied by a downward patting gesture with Top's left hand. The man looked confused. He raised the axe a few inches and stared at it as if he'd never seen it before, as if he had no idea how it got into his hand. Then he blinked a few times and shook his head, trying to clear his thoughts. He looked around, seemingly unsure of where he was.
Yunin?
Said the man in a soft and sleepy voice.
Kainun yodisni.
Those words broke my heart. Sweetheart, where's the dog? What a father might say to his daughter. The axe rose a little higher. Blood ran from the steel head down to the shaft and over the man's hand. I saw the hand begin to tremble, to shake. The axe blade wobbled. In another version of reality, it would have been because of fear, or heartbreak, or the absolute terror of understanding. This wasn't that world. The shaking became more intense, more violent. I saw the man's confusion burn away, saw the glassiness melt from his eyes to be replaced by something beyond insane, by raw, unfiltered, limitless rage. He opened his mouth and howled like a demon. The axe rose high, and Top shot him. The axe dropped from nerveless fingers and struck blade first into the dirt. The man collapsed down beside it, making no attempt to break his fall. That fast. No cry of pain, no struggle to bowl past the effects of the drug. Sandman whispered and consciousness fled. Havoc moved forward and stood in a ragged circle around the man. When the poor bastard fell, he cut his cheek on the axe blade. Bell knelt and rolled him over, then tore a handful of grass, using it to sponge away the blood. Given what that axe had done, and the evidence that lay scattered around, it was a useless gesture, and we all knew it. She touched the man's face, and then reached over and touched the face of the little girl and the dog.
Salam, Yaki,
she murmured. Peace, my brother. It came close to breaking my heart, and it also recalled my own moment on Frog Island when I made the promise to the dead woman. Grief, however borrowed, for a total stranger, was the flag Bell would go to war under. I flew my own, and I suspected Top, Bunny, and Andrea had theirs flying. For Ho, maybe it was for Sergeant Chung, or maybe for an entire island of his countrymen. Only Mun stood apart, looking beyond the horrors there in the grass, studying the parking lot and buildings. She held her dart gun in her right hand, the barrel pointed down. Her head was cocked as she listened to the wind, which was whistling through the trees. I took the axe and slipped the handle through a loop in my harness, letting that blade hang between my shoulders. Everyone watched me do that. No one asked why.
Hello,
said Bell, rising to her feet.
Anya Six.
I turned to see a woman come out from behind a parked golf cart near the building, short, fat, and bloody. She looked around like a startled bird, head bobbing this way and that, body hunched unnaturally. Then she spotted us and stared for a long, awful moment. She opened her mouth and let loose a sound like a cheetah, raspy, raw, and inhuman. She broke into a dead run, barreling straight at us, her breasts flopping under her red spattered shirt, hands pawing at the air as if trying to pull us toward her. Andrea walked toward her, raising his weapon, letting her come close. It was a surreal encounter, the frenzied woman running toward a man who stood with apparent calm. I saw the gun tremble, though. I knew. Andrea let the woman get to within 50 feet and fired. His first round missed. The second did not, and she pitched forward, her dead weight propelled by momentum, and slid on the asphalt of the parking lot, sanding off the skin from hands and chin and cheek. Her body came to rest at the very edge of the grass, fingers touching the first withered stalks.
"Aula,"
said Mun.
"Listen."
I did. We all did. The wind was louder now. Much louder. Swelling moment by moment.
"Oh, fuck,"
said Bunny. It wasn't the sound of the wind whistling through the trees. It was a higher, deeper, wetter sound. It was voices. A lot of them. They were screaming. They were coming for us. Chapter 68. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. It was a tidal surge of madness and murder. Dozens of people came running, drawn by the screams from the woman Andrea had shot. The sounds they made were inhuman, although they came from human throats. It was hard not to think of them as monsters, as things. They were people, sick people, civilians. We ran for a group of parked vehicles to use them as both a shelter and a choke point. The infected would have to squeeze in between the cars and golf carts in order to get us, and we would have the advantage of fewer numbers. We ran like hell and got there first. As we took up positions, using hoods and trunks to steady our aim, Bunny said,
"I'm getting a weird deja vu about all this shit."
"You thinking about last year in Russia?" asked Top.
"No. Thinking about last week in Syria, those guys in the lab coats, the way they moved, like birds. Like these people."
We all looked at him for a moment. Then the moment was gone. The infected rushed us, the first to reach us stumbling as the darts hit them and then being slammed into the vehicles by the wave of people behind. Even with the screams of rage, we could hear the sharp, wet sounds of bones breaking and flesh bursting. I was behind an old Toyota Camry, and the impact rocked it back with such force that two wheels lifted off the ground. Bell, Munn, and I were shoulder to shoulder, firing at them, and there was a change in tone of some of the screams as infected were crushed when the car dropped back down. A boy of about 11 crawled through the golf cart beside me and tried to stab Top with the jagged end of a broken boat oar, but Ho shot him. The boy vanished beneath a mass of seething bodies who crawled over him, smashing the frail body between seat and floor. At times like this, I ask myself, how can a sane and civilized mind adequately process the nature of madness? We can understand the history of psychosis. We can read the body of work on the pathology of madness. We can discuss the warping effects of tumors and drugs, of diseases and damage, but does any of that really ever prepare you to confront a psychological fracture so severe that behavior appears to be evidence of true evil? No. And I've been on battlefields and in conflict with the deranged and the diseased, with the ideologically zealous and the hardest of cold hearts. I should have been able to look at what was unfolding on Yeonpyeong with a clinical detachment. That's not what happened. Havoc Team was in a world where the victims of a bioweapon were able to think clearly enough to use weapons, to hunt prey, to set traps and devise cruelties. Most of the victims were completely deranged, pushed to a level of mad vacuity where the harm they were driven to inflict did not need a target other than their own flesh. There was no clear pattern to any of it except that rage. The attackers weren't even focused entirely on us. As the crowd of them thronged together, they turned on one another, committing unspeakable acts. We saw a man hammering a walking stick down someone's throat with a rubber mallet, the head of the mallet bouncing back, the dying victim kneeling there, fists punching the concrete, weaker each moment. There was a woman fighting with two crab fishers. She had a boat hook in her hands,
and it was slick with blood along its length and on her arms to the elbow. There was a look of such profound hatred in her eyes that it seemed to radiate with palpable heat. Her jaw was clenched so tightly that the muscles of her face were etched like stone. The fishermen were unarmed and kept lunging for her with fingers and teeth, being beaten back each time. A cop walked down the street with a pump shotgun, shooting anything that moved. People, animals, birds, even a sheet of newspaper pushed by the wind. He emptied the gun and then reloaded with such anger that the slot where the shells went cut and abraded his skin. He screamed continuously, drops of blood flecking his lips. A group of seven children ran in a pack, with the two fastest flushing apparently uninfected people out of hiding and into the path of the others. Behind them was a wake of destruction as terrible as that left by a tornado. I heard Belle say something in Arabic that sounded like a prayer, not for the suffering, but for her own soul. Andrea, a man with no religious beliefs, crossed himself. There was a sob, and at first I thought it might have been Bunny, but I was wrong. It was Ho. We raised our guns and shot them all. We shot everyone on the town's main street. We dropped everyone who came at us, everyone who ran, walked, crawled. We did not discriminate for age or gender, men and women, boys and girls, babies and old folks. Our guns found them. Maybe we should have felt better knowing that we were firing tranquilizers that would not kill them. Sure. Tell yourself that when you're firing at a group of little kids, or a pregnant woman, or an old lady with rheumy eyes and little cloisonné kitty cat pins on her sweater. We fired until our magazines were empty, then dropped the empties and swapped in fresh ones, and fired, and fired.
Interlude 16. Aboard the Soul of Piety, Limassol Marina, Cyprus, Greece, 8 months ago.
"You've told me a lot about your operation," said Santoro, "but nothing at all about your clients."
"Our clients, son," said Kuga. He was stretched out on the deck, naked except for an indecent pair of briefs that were molded to his crotch. Skin glistening with oil, sunglasses pointed upward toward the brim of a hat that was tilted low to cover his entire face.
"This is a partnership. Don't know why I can't seem to sell that idea to you."
The marina was packed with dozens of expensive yachts, a few of which were actually bigger than the Soul of Piety. That was as it should be. Kuga liked to be seen as wealthy, but did not want to stand out in any obvious way.
"You are dodging the question."
Santoro sat cross-legged on a cushion under an awning, a glass of iced tea cradled between his palms.
"You always dodge the question."
"Well, in point of fact, I have two different clients right now. Two big ones, I mean, and a hell of a lot of little ones. Hell's concierge is never short on business."
"Who are these big clients?"
Kuga took so long to answer that Santoro thought the man would simply pretend to be asleep.
"One has been a client for a long time now. I've been helping him with a number of interesting requests. Been doing that since before I went to prison. Kept it up inside, thanks to some well-placed friends."
"Like that guard?"
"Like a few guards," said Kuga. "The prison doctor was one of my people, too. Point is, I've been Uncle Vlad's go-to guy for almost 10 years.
"Uncle Vlad?"
mused Santoro.
"As in Vladimir Putin?"
"Sure. Deep pockets and pays well, though recently he's taken a pretty big hit. He's bankrolling some kind of big operation in the States. Don't know what it is, but he says it'll help him launch his Novi Sovietsky scheme."
"New Soviet?" queried Santoro. "I thought that was only an internet rumor."
"Oh, it's real," laughed Kuga. "Uncle Vlad thinks he has a shot at making it happen, too. Don't ask me how, because although I'm happy to take his money, we are not drinking buddies. He doesn't drunk call me and confess his deep, dark secrets. What he is to me, though, is a cash cow. More than a third of what my operation does is tied to him in one way or another.
Who is the other client?
They are a lot more interesting, said Kuga, grinning. A whole lot. They call themselves Dasutnyang E Kangchul Namja.
I don't speak Chinese.
It's Korean, and it means the Five Iron Men. Yeah, I know, sounds like the title of a superhero movie, but it has some ancient cultural significance. Five men representing five very old families who have been deeply involved in some of the most important events in that country's history. Wars, emperors, all that.
What do they want of you?
Of us, corrected Kuga automatically. That's actually a trickier question than you know. These cats won't use two words when only one will work, and they won't use one when they can get away with just a grunt. Hardly the chatty type. He removed the hat and sat up. Despite his usual affectation of indolence and sloth, Kuga moved in a way that spoke of great conditioning. No struggle at all to sit up, no use of hands, all core strength that hid a panther quickness. Kuga stood and padded over to the ice chest, got a bottle of beer, screwed off the top and drank half of it.
What do they want?
He mused, looking at the seabirds bobbing in the water off the starboard rail. Santoro sipped his tea and waited. There's what they told me, said Kuga, and what I think they want.
Meaning?
What they said they wanted was for me to engineer a way to so thoroughly discredit the government of the United States that they are forced to withdraw in a big way from South Korea and the entire region.
Are they North or South Koreans?
Yeah, well, that's where it gets interesting. Three of them live in the South, and the other two are bigwigs in the North, but all of them have large families that were split when the nation was cut in half.
So, therefore, reunification of the two Koreas?
Kuga swirled the beer in the bottle and stared down the mouth to watch the bubbles pop. That's what I think they'd like me to believe.
You doubt them?
I doubt everyone, said Kuga.
Except you.
Santoro said nothing to that and instead asked,
What, then, is their real motive?
Haven't totally sussed that out yet. I have my computer geeks tearing apart their emails and anything else they can sneak into.
You have a suspicion, though.
Kuga drank. It's only that, he said. But, yeah. Two of them have pretty strong ties with China, business ties, and it's not both of the guys in the North. It's one of them and one of the cats in the South, unconnected businesses. I'll bet you a bottle of Chateau Petrus, the 2010 vintage, that all five of them have business interests with China. If the U.S. leaves or their presence is diminished, then China gets to come to the financial rescue of both Koreas. China's on the move, becoming a much bigger economy than any communist ideology should allow. I think our five iron men are in this for the money and the stability. Even if there isn't a reunified Korea, if China is Big Daddy, then commerce and travel between the countries will improve, and families will reunite. Santoro thought about that and slowly nodded.
Do you think you can make America retreat?
Huh? God, no. Even I'm not that clever.
But,
said Kuga, I'm pretty damn sure I can get them thrown out.
Chapter 69. The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Nikki Bloom, Bug's second-in-command, was on her fifth cup of coffee while hammering away to enter search arguments into the pattern recognition program. Rudy sat a few yards away, rereading the transcripts of his interviews with Rafael Santoro. Suddenly Nikki leaped to her feet and yelled, "Holy forking shirtballs!" Everyone's head whipped around, but before anyone could ask what was wrong, they saw it. Nikki sent a BBC news feed to the main screen. There, Larger than life and crystal clear was a team of men and women dressed as Republic of Korea soldiers and American Navy SEALs, deploying a series of small drones into the air above a beach on a remote island. The sound was bad and tinny because the mic was not close to the team, but one voice seemed to cut through the distortion. A male voice, clearly an American accent. "When Kim Jong-un hears about this, he's going to know not to fuck with Uncle Sam." Nikki stood aghast, her eyes wide, mouth slack, but her hands were busy as she sent feeds from other global news stations to the other screens. 2, 5, 11, 30. Bakhtar News Agency, Agence Kampuchea Press, BBC News, China News Service, MSNBC, Ritzau, Suomen Tieto Toimisto, WAFA, Agencia Lusa, TASS, Tanjug, Channel News Asia, Newsis, Yonhap, Associated Press, CNN, Fox, Al Jazeera, Reuters, Khovar, Lankapuvat, Myanmar News Agency, Bernama, Gigi Press, Islamic Republic News Agency, Samachar Bharti. Rudy stopped counting. His head swam and he gripped the edge of a desk to keep from falling down.
"Ay, Dios mio,"
Rudy breathed.
"It's out. Oh, my dear God, it's out."
Chapter 70. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. As the darts hit, the raging people fell. Just like that. There was no struggle, no attempt to shake off the effects. They went down where they stood, weapons falling from slack fingers, eyelids fluttering shut, bodies sagging as the dreadful inner tensions were snapped off, as if breakers were tripped inside their heads. We stood in a ragged line, a kind of half-circle with our backs to the wall of a crab shack, loading and firing, covering for each other during reloads. The Snellig dart gun's range wasn't that great, but the effect was so fast that it didn't matter, and we did not need to make accurate shots. No headshots, as with Saif al-Din. The darts had to break the skin, and all of us were good enough shots to do that.
"Are you sure this is safe?"
demanded Ho, who had so far shot only 3 people, 2 men and a young woman. However, there was a rising note to his voice that was not quite hysteria, but definitely in that zip code. "It's safe," I said, but Doc Holliday's voice overrode me via the team channel.
"It's been tested on adults of all ages up to 70 and with kids as young as 15. We don't know the effect on children or infants. We don't know the effect on pregnant women, but the chemicals should not be able to cross the placental barrier."
Ho looked wildly around as if expecting Doc to be there, but I knew it wasn't her he was seeing. He was looking at the people who lay in silent heaps around us. Some of them were children. 2 were toddlers. And there were 3 women who were visibly pregnant. I could see his mouth through the plexiglass visor, and it was working, forming words that he could not or dared not say aloud. His telemetry was being sent to the TOC, and I could only imagine where his pulse rate and blood pressure were. The pistol began rattling in his grip as shudders whipped through his body. Beside him, Major Mun made a disgusted noise and shoved Ho unkindly aside, firing as a man in mechanic's overalls rushed forward. He dropped, and then she took a teenage girl with a shot to the face, and then a mailman. Her eyes were steady, cold, merciless, and I had no doubt that if she'd been allowed to fire live rounds, she would have done so with equal efficiency and obvious lack of emotion. That troubled me because it was the kind of military efficiency that crossed a line into a dangerous coldness. Not just hardened to the exigencies of warfare, and not the rancid love of bloodshed, but a complete disconnect from humanity on either end of the gun. There was a part of me that wanted to take her off the firing line, to stand her down until I could understand who she really was as a person and a soldier. But there was no time for that. The infected of Yeonpyeong kept coming at us, drawn by the sound of conflict and the screams of people who were beyond their minds with uncontrollable fury. In strange and somewhat perverse contrast, our dart guns made soft sounds, almost gentle. Pfft,
quieter than a sound suppressor, a nothing sound that was lost amid their screams and our own labored breathing. The scene was surreal. I'd been in firefights more times than I could count, and I've faced down mobs of infected, but in those cases it was a gunfight, or guns against the living dead. This was us fighting people we might actually be able to save, provided we figured out what the disease was and could concoct a cure or treatment. Grief stabbed us with every trigger pull, even though we were not murdering anyone. The emotions were twisted out of shape. And yet, around us, it was a lovely day. The December sky was a hard blue you could scratch a match on. Unseasonably warm sunlight sparkled on the water, and there were birds singing in the trees. How was this the world? How did the actions and the environment fit into one dimension? Where in all of this was sanity, or God, or hope?
On your left,
yelled Top, and I turned as a small pack of them came howling toward us, 9 of them running together, each of them spattered with blood from the crimes they'd committed, all of them armed with pipes or wrenches or pieces of wood. One had a human arm, a woman's, I think, that he brandished like a club. I wanted to kill him. More him than the others, even though it was obvious every one of this bunch had done awful things to their friends and neighbors. But the man waving the arm was emblematic of the deep horror of this, and the killer in my head wanted to extinguish that, to erase it and the possibility of it from the tribal consciousness, to deny its potential and prevent such horrors from spreading like an infection. I fired and tried to hold my ground, but they came fast. Flies were everywhere, drawn by the smell of blood in the air, and they crawled over my visor. They swarmed in the air, too small to be targets of our bullets or of the rage of the infected. Bunny and Bell moved to flank me, and we took them all down. It felt obscene to do it so easily. 9 of them, 3 of us, 4 seconds. I felt bile in my throat, as if we'd slaughtered them. How could Junie so misunderstand me as to think I was unmoved by combat? Or, maybe more truly, how could I be so detached from her as to not explain these things to the one person who cared more for me than anyone else? If there was a failure in perception and empathy, it had to be mine. The fight, if you could call something as one-sided as this a fight, went on minute after endless minute. We began making our way through the town, sweating out our fear and horror as we walked beneath the unrelenting sun. I saw sunlight through the throng and realized that the crowd was thinning. We were gaining the tactical edge here, despite their numbers. Within a couple of minutes, the last of the closest ones were down, piled in heaps over their neighbors. "We need to get to the docks," I said. "That's where the administration buildings are. Everyone reload." They did. We each wore sweatbands around our brows beneath our hoods, but the suits were boiling. Moisture pooled in our eye sockets and ran down to soak our clothes. Dehydration was going to become an issue pretty quickly. I rose up. "Moving," I shouted, and they peeled off and followed, watching left and right and behind. The streets were like a war zone, with people torn to pieces in very ugly ways. There were no uninfected people along our route. Ho was beside me and pointed to various corpses here and there.
"See that?"
he said, indicating where a woman had clearly tried to hide inside a parked car. She was still held fast by her seatbelt, but the windshield had been smashed in so that someone could stab her in the throat with a long metal pole. One hand had been punctured and impaled on the pole.
"That's a defensive wound. None of the other infected we've encountered tried to defend themselves. They were all postures of pure aggression."
"Which tells you what?" I asked.
"I don't know for sure, but I'd guess that she was uninfected when she died. She tried to hide rather than attack. That's suggestive. I need to take some samples from her."
We paused, standing in a defensive ring around the car while Ho worked.
"Make it quick, painkiller," prompted Top. "Feel like I'm standing here with my dick out."
"Yes," said Bell. "This movement ahead coming fast."
Done, he said, as he used a Sharpie to scroll notes on a sample container into which he thrust vials of blood and spit. We moved on. The infected came at us from open doorways, and I noticed that they seemed to react to us once they saw or heard us. There weren't swarms of them actively hunting, or so it seemed. I filed that away for later consideration. With every person who fell, and every corpse we stepped over, I could feel a gradual shift inside my own head. The killer was not firing that gun. It was not his kind of gun, and not his kind of fight. No. It was the cop. Cold and professional, observing everything, seeing what cried out to be seen, pinning it all to the walls inside that aspect of my mind. He was working the case because that's what he did best. That's why his personality was the one I most related to, the one that kept me steady and found a pathway through the landscape of horrors.
"Hello?" called Munn. "That plant over there. It has a solid wall and good views of the street. We can catch our breath."
"Do it," I said, and she led the way toward the wharf, where a small crab processing plant stood next to a more official-looking municipal building. Swarms of black flies buzzed all around us. They seemed agitated. Many more of them hung in dark, roiling clouds around the infected. Everyone began doing a quick weapons check, reloading, taking a breath, fighting down the shakes. While I fitted in a new magazine of Sandman darts, Bunny's words from earlier came back to me. He was right in that the infected here did move in the same awkward, bird-like way as had the lab-coated techs and test subjects back in Syria. I reached up to tap my comms unit to switch to a private channel with the talk when I heard Doc Holliday yell in my ear,
"Hello, we've lost all video and..."
Then the line went dead.
"What the hell?" growled Top.
Suddenly a shot rang out and I heard a big, wet cough directly behind me. Colonel Host staggered as the entire front of his face mask exploded outward, spraying all of us with red and chunks of gray brain tissue. His body collapsed in an artless tangle of thrashing limbs.
"Sniper!"
roared Bell and Top at the same time, and then the whole world seemed to disintegrate into a madness of gunfire. Chapter 71. BBC World News, April Llewellyn reporting.
Disturbing news emerged today from the North Korean island of Gaegulisyom. What at first appeared to be an outbreak of an as yet unknown disease form may in fact be the work of terrorists. Video footage has been sent by the radical whistleblower news group Punk Press that appears to show armed soldiers on the beach of that island at around the same time as a presumed bioweapon was released. The Punk Press video shows many casualties among the civilian population.
Chapter 72. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. I crouched and spun, but before I could take a step, something smashed me sideways. It was Bunny. He had one arm hooked around Bell's waist and had rammed me with his massive shoulder as automatic gunfire filled the air and bullets chewed up the ground where I'd been standing. We fell hard on the concrete beneath the tin roof overhang of a crab shack, then rolled apart. Bell came up on one knee, holstering her dart gun aside and swinging her rifle around from behind her back. She swept the rooftops, looking for targets, firing at anything that moved. Bunny and I dodged to opposite sides of the crab shack, also swapping weapons. The gunfire was continuous and raining down from elevated positions. There was a lot of it, too. A barrage that chased Havoc Team behind cover. Ho lay on the ground with his head torn apart, but still impossibly, horribly alive. He twitched and thrashed, caught inside an envelope of personal agony. The bullet had slung his blood 7 feet high onto the wall behind which I hid. Top, Andrea, and Major Munn had scrambled for the cover of parked cars, letting the metal vehicles soak up the rounds. Window glass exploded and the hood and fenders popped as if in a hailstorm. I saw Top looking at me and yelling, but there was no sound in my ear. The comms were dead. That's what Bug had tried to tell me before things went to hell.
Andrea was all but punching the keys of his wrist computer, but the machines were not answering to his call.
"So much for gadgets," said Bunny, having to lean toward me and yell. "We need to go old school on these fuckers, but where the hell are they?"
The rounds were coming in so hot, he wasn't able to look around the corner. Splinters filled the air like hornets.
"Up there,"
answered Belle, who had crabbed sideways behind a stack of big spools of electrical cable.
"Count 12, maybe more."
I took a small mirror on a stick and angled it to give me a quick peek around the corner. 30 yards away was a one-story dockmaster's office with a cinder block half wall around the top. A big air conditioner unit and a radio tower dominated the roof, but all along that wall were figures silhouetted against the winter sky. I couldn't make out any details, except that there were at least a dozen of them. They were all in black hammer suits, and they were all firing down at us.
"Well, the hell with this crap,"
complained Bunny. He had his big Acheson AA-12 shotgun in his hands with a big 32-round drum magazine in place. I saw that the magazine was marked with a little red heart, which was Bunny's way of indicating that it was loaded with explosive rounds instead of buckshot. He didn't dare stick his head out and instead pointed the barrel around the corner, tilted it up, and began firing.
"Merry fucking Christmas, assholes,"
Bunny thundered. He was loaded with modified frag 12 high-explosive rounds and had his weapon set to full auto, which gave him a fire rate of 300 rounds per minute. He burned through the full magazine in seconds, his huge frame braced for the continuous recoil. Each round was a fin-stabilized 19mm warhead that, once fired, arms itself as soon as it travels 3 meters from the muzzle and detonates on impact. The HE rounds are designed to punch a 1-inch diameter hole through a 1/4-inch steel plate. The cinder block wall had no chance at all. Neither did three of the shooters behind that wall. I saw bodies leap into the air, trailing blood and debris. The other shooters scattered. Belle reached up and patted Bunny's brawny shoulder.
"My brother," she said.
Then there was a shout behind me.
"Outlaw on your six!"
I heard a muffled voice and whirled as Top ran past me, letting his rifle drop to hang from its sling as he drew his dart gun. A swarm of infected were running toward us, climbing over the bodies of their fellow citizens. Some of those bodies were sleeping in the arms of Sandman, but others lay bleeding and gasping out their lives from the bullets that missed us, but not them. Andrea tried to grab Ho and drag him to cover, but the gunfire chased him away. Munn began firing, but to my horror, I saw she had her standard-issue rifle and was hosing the infected civilians with live rounds. Top stepped up and knocked the barrel high. She staggered, then in a moment of apparent anger, kicked Top in the groin, or tried to. Top twisted quick as a snake and took the blow on his hip, then stepped right into Munn, once more slapping the rifle away as she tried to lower the barrel, seemingly to point at him. He hit her in the chest with a hard, straight punch that, despite body armor, knocked her back and down hard on her ass. Top tore the gun from her hands and flung it away and pointed at her, not with his weapon, but with a stiff finger. I couldn't hear what he said, but she stayed down. Tension and fury emanated from her like waves of nuclear radiation. Bunny cut me a look, and through his visor I saw him raise one eyebrow as if asking if Munn had lost her shit. I shrugged. The situation was too raw, and she was an unknown. This was her country, so it was possible the stress was shoving her into some strange psychological shape. Even good soldiers can react wrong if the moment falls apart around them. I prayed to whatever God was on call that the jammers killed all live feeds from our body cams. If any diplomat, or worse, head of state, saw her slaughtering civilians, then this whole thing was going to fall down. Maybe that action wouldn't be a cause for war since she was South Korean and so were the civilians, but it could churn already troubled waters. Who knows what political damage it might do? Andrea began firing at the dockmaster's office, which was now actively burning. I was busy with the infected, using the Snellig to drop them as they came close, but there were a lot of them and they were moving fast. Ho lay between the infected and the rest of Havoc, and despite everything, he was still moving, clawing feebly at the ground with his fingers. The situation, which at first had been terrible and heartbreaking, had gone through desperate and was about to set its next foot on empty air. And I had to assume they were the fake SEALs and Korean soldiers, were on the street level now, sending a new fusillade our way, while the street behind us was filling up with dozens of the infected. Chapter 73. The Economist. No byline given. In response to the punk press video purportedly showing South Korean and United States special forces deploying a bioweapon on a small fishing island, North Korean President Kim Jong-un issued this boldly worded statement. The massacre committed by the United States imperialist aggressions on Gaegulisyom is proof that they are murderers seeking pleasure in the slaughter of innocent people. They think they can commit such atrocities with impunity, but forget that we have new type intercontinental ballistic rockets with nuclear warheads that can strike to the very heart of their evil cesspool of a nation. Interlude 17. Danubius Hotel Gellert, Budapest, Hungary, 6 months ago. Santoro looked up sharply as the door opened. Kuga stood there, his blue eyes clicking here and there, taking in the whole scene. It angered the Spaniard. He did not, absolutely did not, like to be interrupted while working, not even by Kuga.
"Why are you here?" he asked sharply. "I thought you preferred a more administrative distance from the real work."
Kuga stood in the open doorway, his polished loafers inches from the congealing pool of crimson. Then he closed the door behind him, took a pack of bubble gum from the inner breast pocket of his impeccable Ermengildo Zegna sports coat, unwrapped two sticks, and chewed thoughtfully. He did not reply to Santoro's comment. Not in words, but he stared at the little Spaniard until even Santoro looked uncomfortable. The little killer cleared his throat and gave a tiny bow of apology. They stood on opposite sides of a room awash with blood. The sound system was playing a Holly's Best Of playlist. The current track was The Air That I Breathe, a romantic and very sexy song that could not have been more completely at odds with what was going on here. Or maybe not, mused Kuga. Santoro had a noticeable bulge in his pants. Maybe this was sex to him. There was one little patch of clean floor, and Kuga stood in that. The three figures strapped to chairs barely looked human anymore. Only one of them was actually dead. The others faced the inhuman thing that sagged and dripped. Both of them were gagged and blindfolded. Beyond them stood Santoro in his plastic blood suit, and in a corner, holding hands, dressed similarly, were two young people. Kuga gave them a long, considering appraisal, the way a hunter examines bloodhound pups in a pen. "This is them." The girl smiled.
"I'm Eve, and this is—"
But Santoro silenced her with a gunshot snap of his fingers. She immediately flushed as red as the blood on her clothes. The boy, Adam, stood staring. He was big and strong and looked dangerous, but he stood, shackled by uncertainty. Santoro said something to Adam, who opened a leather case on one of the room's two queen beds and removed headphones. He placed them on each of the two surviving prisoners, then connected wires to them and adjusted the volume on the music. He nodded. Kuga leaned back against the door and looked at the three bound people. You couldn't tell much about who they were or where they came from. Their hair was soaked and plastered to their heads and was the color of wet brick. There wasn't a single inch of skin that was not painted with red or purpled with bruises. He nodded to the dead man.
"Who did him?"
Eve started to say something, hesitated, stopped, looked at the floor.
"Eve is particularly enthusiastic," said Santoro.
"Is that a nice word for clumsy?" asked Kuga. He blew a pink bubble. It popped with a satisfying sound, and he sucked it into his mouth.
"Not at all," said the Spaniard. "Our guest was very forthcoming. Access codes, patrol schedules, timetables.
Enough? Santoro gave one of his shrugs.
I do not believe he had anything useful left to say.
Kuga glanced at the bed. Clothing stood in three neatly folded piles, two uniforms and one business suit. He popped his gum.
These other two going to give us the rest of what we need? He asked.
Without a doubt.
Kuga nodded, popped his gum again, and reached for the doorknob.
Then get back to work.
He shot cold looks at Adam and Deve, but pointed to Santoro.
You two listen to me. This man is my friend and my business partner. But more than that, he is an artist. He is the best of the best of the best. You keep your heads out of your asses, and maybe, maybe you'll be a tenth as good, which will make you five times better than anyone else you meet. Studying under him is a gift, and maybe you're smart enough to recognize how valuable a gift it is. I hope so. He seems to think so. Do not disappoint him. If so, then you won't have him to answer to. Trust me when I tell you that you do not want to make me mad.
He chuckled, warm as an uncle on Christmas morning.
No, you really don't want that.
He blew another bubble, watching what his words did to their eyes and the shapes of their mouths. Then he gave them a friendly wink and went out. Chapter 74 The Talk. Church took the call from Jerry Spencer while watching Havoc Team fight their way across Yeonpyeong Island. He stepped into a quiet corner before answering.
Detective Spencer, said Church, I've been waiting for your call.
Yeah? Well, you're not going to like what I have to say, muttered Spencer.
No, said Church, I expect not.
Chapter 75 Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. There are moments in a person's life that truly define them. It's as if the universe distills everything down in simpler choices, even if those choices are both bad. At least you understand them. You do this or you do that. If you do neither, you die, and maybe that's what you deserve. Inaction is action in its own way. It's the victim's choice. I can't decide, so have your way with me. In that golden moment, if your will to live is strong enough, you eliminate that weak option and focus on the two bad choices. Which one will kill me first? Or, contrarily, which choice will demand that the universe work that much harder to cut me down? Which choice will matter most? It's not about survival, really. It's about staying alive long enough to make sure that your death serves a purpose. It's you spitting in the devil's eye and telling him to go fuck himself because even if his knights and rooks are about to slaughter your king, you are willing to simply knock over the chessboard. That was the moment by the crab shack. We had certain death in front of us and behind us, but here's the thing about certainty. Just as that old saying, man plans, God laughs, is true, so is the philosophy of a certain kind of soldier on certain kinds of battlefields. And I'm not just talking about those wearing uniforms and fighting for a flag. It's as true of a bullied kid with his back to a boy's bathroom wall as it is of a woman who will not be punched down to the floor again by her asshole husband. It's true of people who have had almost everything stripped away from them, but that last bit of pride, that last spark of fire. And what is that philosophy? It's not some beautifully phrased bit of philosophic insight. It's not a pithy aphorism or a memorable catchphrase. Nah, nothing like that. It's just this. If you want me, you have to earn it, and I'm going to make it very goddamn expensive for you. Chapter 76 Al Jazeera, D.S. Mongolfi reporting. Many nations have issued statements in support of North Korea and openly condemning the actions of the United States and South Korea in the strongest possible terms. China and Russia are threatening to close American embassies and eject all U.S. government and private citizens.
This tragedy comes at a critical time in world politics as North and South Korea, China, and the United States, along with five other nations, have gathered in Oslo for the D9 denuclearization summit, scheduled to begin in 2 days. The nine world leaders are already in Norway, but their embassies and hotels have had their security statuses raised to severe. It is not yet known whether the world leaders will cancel the summit and return home. There is an air of extreme tension throughout Oslo and the world.
Chapter 77. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea.
"Pappy, jackpot," I barked. "Cover our backs. Dart them if you can, but stop them."
They rose up without question and began firing.
"Donnie Darko, Mother Mercy, on me."
I took a fistful of Major Munn's hammer suit and hauled her roughly to her feet. She tried to slap my hand away, but I kept my grip. I had to lean close to be heard.
"Listen to me and hear me. We're in the shit and you are with us or you're not. Tell me right now and make me believe it. The comms and body cams are down, so if you fuck with me, no one will ever know who put one in your brain pan. Are you reading me on this?"
"Take your hands off me," she snarled.
Instead of that, I gave her a shake that probably loosened her fillings and then jerked her forward until her mask was hard against mine.
"I don't know what your problem is, Major, but right now you are not among friends."
"No," said Belle, shifting close. "You're not."
"Hoo-ah," said Bunny. "No fucking around," I said coldly, giving Mun another rough shake. "Are you with us or not?"
She looked into my eyes, and she did, in fact, hear me and see me. I could see the understanding in her face.
"Yes,"
she said hoarsely.
"I'm sorry about..."
"I don't give a flying fuck what you're sorry about. Are you with us or not? Say it clear and make me believe it."
Something shifted in her. Even her posture changed. She stopped trying to pull away and instead stood firm and straightened. She gave a slow, firm nod.
"I'm with you," she said.
I watched her eyes. Mun was tough as nails and she met my glare, but there was a flicker there, as if she wanted or perhaps needed to look away. It troubled me, but we were in the shit, so I had to accept her word. For now. I let her go. I didn't shove her back or any of that shit. I let her go. However, I saw Belle point a finger like a pistol and then use her thumb to drop the hammer. Mun stepped away, picked up her rifle, checked the magazine, and turned toward the edge of the wall that was being continually chewed apart by gunfire.
"What's the plan, boss?" asked Bunny.
I was not in a mood for niceties. I plucked two fragmentation grenades from my harness.
"Plan? How about a nice big cup of fuck you?"
Bunny grinned and pulled two of his own. We pulled the pins and lobbed them in a tight arc over the wall of the crab shack. The second they blew, I was moving, running low, firing into the smoke. Mun beside me, with Bunny and Belle flanking us. The bad guys had the numbers. We had one moment of utter confusion. That's my kind of math. I saw shapes reeling in the cloud of red-tinged dust and fired into it as I ran. Bullets punched through the air, but I didn't care. This wasn't a fight. This was murder. We took it to them, closing to zero distance as we hosed them with rounds. I heard Bunny cough out a cry of pain as bullets hit him, but he powered through the foot-pounds of impact, letting the body armor do its work and making the bad guys pay for the searing pain in his chest. One of the ROK soldiers, his weapon empty and no time to fish for a new magazine, swung his rifle stock at Belle, but she shot him in the face and kicked him at the same time. He reeled back, his dead weight screening her, as she closed on a second man and killed him too. Belle, small and wiry and fast, emptied an entire magazine into a pair of soldiers who were trying to shift away out of the smoke in order to get a better look at their targets. They wasted a second doing that, and she killed them for their stupidity. On the other side of me, Mun was firing with a handgun, holding it in both hands as she walked forward, aiming, firing, killing, aiming. I thought I'd seen her hesitate for a moment at first, but now she was doing her job. There were a total of 11 of the bad guys left after Bunny's earlier barrage and my grenade. We could have hidden behind obstacles and spent all afternoon sniping at each other. This wasn't that kind of fight. We had that moment of advantage, and we took it. And we killed them all. When I lowered my gun and turned around, Top and Andrea stood side by side, chests heaving, dart guns hanging at their sides in front of a mountain of infected. I looked around for more enemies to fight. Saw none. Beyond the tiny town was the bright blue water, the wave tops traced with gold, and a line of clouds peering with frightened interest over the horizon line. Chapter 78. CNN, the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer.
We begin this hour with breaking news from North Korea. A shocking and deeply disturbing story is unfolding. The video you are about to see contains strong images and viewers are cautioned.
The graphic for Punk Press fills the screen. Chapter 79. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. They were all down. They were not all dead. We formed a tight circle, guns up and out, as we turned like a dial, scanning for targets, maybe hungry for them. Birds, shocked to silence, stood like witnesses to what we'd done. Nothing moved except the smoke. One of the soldiers, a slender man with a Korean face, was on his knees, his body running with blood. He had a pistol in his hand, but it was pointed down. Mun was moving toward him, her gun pointing at his heart. Bunny pointed his shotgun at the man, too.
"Drop the weapon," he bellowed. "Do it right now or I will kill you."
The man did not drop the gun, but Bunny never had a chance to follow up on his threat because the soldier swept the pistol up, jammed the barrel under his own chin, and pulled the trigger. The bullet punched a big red hole in the top of the hammer suit hood, and then the man was down, reduced to cooling meat in a microsecond. Mun, who was closest, was splashed with blood and bits of bone. She stood stock still, eyes wide, mouth open, her gun pointing nowhere.
"What the actual fuck?"
gasped Bunny. "Check the others," I ordered, and Havoc began moving among the dead. One of the attackers was still alive, body torn by grenade shrapnel. He crawled slowly away from the scene of slaughter, leaving a glistening red slug trail behind him. I removed my nearly empty magazine and replaced it with one heavy with unspent potential. The man on the ground was looking over his shoulder, and through a cracked and torn